Rome's responsibility for the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. The gentleman who compiled all this information, put it all in the book. You can find it. You can find this letter and source that he used in the court.
Okay.
He basically made this guy look like a complete idiot with the scandal that he was trying to do against this other guy that was trying to leave the Catholic faith. And this guy ended up Father Chinique. And he later on would visit Lincoln saying, you know, they're probably going to try to take you out. You've already made them really mad. And he's like, I have no doubt that they will. And there's even a quote in 63 of Lincoln even saying, if the American people knew how much the Catholic Church was distorting our education, blah, 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 then this guy, I mean, this is a direct quote. And nobody is bringing this fact up that he realized if he had said anything that the Catholics were behind a lot of the motivation in the South, or they were influencing and have workings down there, that this would turn into a religious war, as opposed to just a civil war. And he says that's going to be 10 times worse than what we got right now.
Welcome to Far Out with Faust, everybody. I am Faust Piccio, and today I'm very excited to be joined by Brandon Kroll. Let me tell you about Brandon, what he's been up to. This guy is a data analyst at heart, whatever he says. He loves researching history, reading, writing. He loves fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. He loves writing about conspiracy facts, although he might mention them as theories. Those are some of his favorite topics to write about. He was president of his college's newspaper and book club, and while there, he was published in the school's literary journal twice for second place in a statewide writing competition. So he's also great with the pen or the keyboard, whatever you prefer these days. Brandon, thank you so much for beaming in, brother. It's great to have you on the show.
I appreciate being on your show. Thank you for the invite.
Yeah, man. So let me tell you, full disclosure, how I came across Brandon. He follows me on Instagram. And a lot of his content, you know, very much it cross pollinates with mine. And he has continuously commented in a way that is very generous with his knowledge and helpful towards whatever crazy post I've put up. And his comments always are provocative and they're great. So finally, I was like, hey, I gotta pick this guy's brain. He has a lot of knowledge, some stuff that I never heard of. And so I was like, dude, you gotta come on. And he's like, all right. So, Brandon, what am I missing, man? Anything about you that I should have mentioned that I didn't?
Well, I guess one thing is like, my educational aspect background, like we were talking prior, I only made it to sixth grade because there was a lot of issues going on with the homeschooling aspect. We were going to do a move, didn't do a move. It ended up, you know, getting postponed. Schooling was all packed up. So I just ended up taking a GED and then going straight to college. So
and you were adopted, you mentioned, right?
Yeah, at four.
Okay. Wow. And so you got a GED in sixth grade?
From sixth grade to GED, yeah.
Wow. I have a few friends that dropped out when we were in like ninth and 10th grade who ended up getting their GED, but I've never heard of anyone getting it so young.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, it was kind of like, it's either that or I'm just going to be in school for forever. But I was like, you know what? I got to bite the bullet and get done with this. So I did.
Cool, man. I was going to ask you about that a little later, but, you know, So then you still found a way into college and more schooling, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you had a thirst for knowledge. You didn't, I mean, a lot of people just would have said the hell with it, but you pursued it anyway. And you, I know you went to college and you got into writing, right?
I tried to do journalism because I first thought that was going to be a thing that I would be interested in, but the way the classroom in the school was worked, it was like almost like the teachers were almost incredibly nervous all the time because a lot of them would be just graduating themselves then starting to teach. So it didn't give me the right vibe check. And even going down there, I mean, that was I wasn't exactly what you call exceptional. I had a little bit of a rough side to me first getting down there. I was on a first name basis with a lot of the deans.
Yeah, I know how that is.
I came back to Connecticut, and I made Dean's List at my local community college. I honestly did not know what that was. I had to Google it because I thought I was in trouble. And I was clutching the mail.
I'm on another list. That's fascinating. That's hilarious.
You're Shelter Team Schooler, total disclosure, I was like, I had no idea what that was. So when I got that for like a couple of years in a running, I was like, okay, well, that's new.
That's hilarious, man.
Yeah.
That's cool though. Good for you, dude. Look, it's not easy being an orphan. That is a big thing to overcome. A lot of people can't and don't. So kudos to you there. And the fact that you were like, you know what? I want to learn more. I'm gonna go where I can to do that. Good for you, dude. That's awesome. So before we jump into some of these topics I'm excited about, tell me about this. Tell me what this means. I think this will give people a little idea of you too. In one of your posts, you said that you are 100% Christocrat, which that's more self-evident than some of these other ones. You said you're 65% Carlinist, which I was like, Carlinist, and 25% Zappian, Frank Zappa. Tell me who those two cats are and what you were talking about with this.
Yeah. On the following slide, I go into a little bit more detail. I'm like, I'm also 10%. Politically agnostic, as Sylvester Stallone one time said on Hannity. And the Carlin aspect is a lot of times when I'm watching George Carlin.
Oh, George Carlin. Okay.
Yes. The next slide, I went a little bit more in detail. But a lot of the stuff that I watch of his, minus his atheistic view and abortion, I liked a lot of his views, his cynicisms. I don't see a lot of comedians as just comedians. I see that more as a philosopher with a comedic perspective on outlook of life. And if we're paying attention, we can actually learn a lot of things. And I look at Carlin as a modern day Diogenes. The stuff that he calls out, the things that he's trying to relay to his audience, he's telling the audience truths and he's laughing at them and they're laughing back at him. But he's like, if you understood what I'm saying, this should be resonating with you. I'm talking about you.
Right. No, he's a prophet.
Yes. He is
just so far ahead of his time. Just incredible. The things that were coming out of his mouth. I mean, he was so far ahead of the game. Mm-hmm. My God, if he was around now, they would have had to cancel him about 50 times over.
They would have crucified.
You know, had his finger out the whole time.
Yep. Like,
he was amazing, man. So just incredible dude.
Yeah.
And then so you're very Christian.
Yeah. Which is ironic because with my upbringing, there was a, what do you call it? Like, kind of like a hypocritical undertone. My dad was very adamant with us with like our reading or schooling, like make sure the curriculum was very Christian based, Christian background. But there were issues going on in the household that was, it was very questionable. Let's just put it that way. And the fact that I still would want to stick to my faith through that, I think a lot of people probably would have been like, it's all a joke, it's all a sham. Yeah. But I saw past of what is based on the individual and what is actually, you can look past that and focus on the core of your faith, not necessarily the individual that distorted it.
Good for you. Again, you're an exception, you know. So I just got back from, I was with Greg Braden for 4 days and he was showing these amazing pictures. He has like a Holy Land trip in Jerusalem. And, you know, he's like showing us, you know, this is where they laid Jesus's body, and really powerful sites. And I mean, the home of Mary Magdalene. And so that's actually becoming its own, now that they're discovering more and more about Mary Magdalene and how much part she played with Jesus's life. And that's another very controversial thing for people who are Catholic, you know, because you see, it doesn't say that in the Bible and the Gospels that are offered in the traditional text. But when you get into the new texts, she becomes very much a part of his life. I'm wondering where you fall on that. If you are like more traditional, or.
I'd say I lean more traditional, only for the reason being is that his purpose wasn't for mating. It was more so of creating. I mean, I could go on a whole rabbit trail if you want right now explaining the aspect of communion and why I would say that would
not necessarily like debunk, but it would put a very counteractive argument on the little evil there of trying to see yes or no.
It's fascinating. Yeah, you know, I was raised Catholic, so I know the tradition a lot, but it was always very hard to believe. And I always thought, okay, I don't understand why is there a demonization of women, you know, and femininity in general has been kind of taken out of, and this is, you know, it's obviously a very Catholic thing. And then you have the whole thing with like, why are the priests so confused? Oh, I don't know. You know, why aren't they married? What's the point? What, you know, I have a lot of problems with it, but, We don't need to get into it too much.
And even what you're talking about, if anything, if you want to go into like stuff that makes people at my church upset, just start asking about the verse Genesis 6:4 with the sons of God coming down, having, you know, affairs with the daughters of men, because yeah. This starts a whole rabbit trail of issues and it starts debunking the thing of where Christ is on this, because a book I was reading by Dr. Michael Heiser, Reversing Mount Hermon, he was explaining how the whole genealogy of Christ is showing how he loves women and how they utilized the buildup of who he became, why it was important to have every single one of those women represented. They didn't say all the traditional ones that we hear in the Bible. It talked about the ones that were barely mentioned. And then when you explore the background of each one of those individuals, the metaphorical power behind that is just like, wow, he's actually very much pro-women. So the idea of condensing it and just saying like, oh no, women are supposed to shut up, just listen to their husbands, you know, they have no place nor say, totally not biblical, totally not biblical. Just like slavery.
Yeah.
It's just that when I was reading about the Knights of the Golden Circle and their stance, like saying, well, yeah, I was set down by the Jehovah God that it's an ordained institution. It's just like, no, it's not. I don't know where you're drawing this conclusion. There was a time and place for it. And it wasn't necessary at that time when they were trying to install the Golden Circle, which again, I don't know why history doesn't talk about it. But anyways,
we'll revisit that because I'm interested. Yeah. But speaking of slavery, you know, you have some fascinating information about the Civil War, and I know it's one of the areas that you've accumulated a lot of knowledge of, and it, you know, there's a, like my 11-year-old was just learning about the Civil War and he's in fifth grade, and, you know, and I'm like, what are they telling you? I'm like, tell me what they're telling you so I can try to fill you in on, you know, what's really going on. But, you know, you mentioned how Rome was involved in the assassination of Lincoln. And, you know, like most presidents who get knocked off, there's usually a lot of reasons that build up to, to have them put on this list, you know. And but Rome is something that I know the Vatican's, God, it's the Vatican itself is just such a, it's just like, I don't know what good has ever come out of the Vatican. I feel like it was designed for the opposite purpose of what people are taught in the Catholic religion that it's designed for. But you know, tell me how, first of all, most people believe the Civil War is about slavery. Abraham Lincoln is the hero. You know, he was morally against, and I'm not doubting that this is actually true, but of course we know that there were a lot more things involved and a reason why there was a Civil War in America. Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering, enlighten me about some of the things that I probably don't know, and then go into, you know, how Rome was involved with Lincoln's assassination.
So you kind of want a buildup of what the Civil War led to?
Yeah, like, you know, I most people have a decent idea of it, and maybe not so decent these days, but, you know, we know that he was shot by John Wilkes Booth.
Yes. Yeah.
We know it was in a theater, right? Mm-hmm. We know that he was a hero and that he went to war with the South, and it was a grueling war. And that, you know, most people believe that it was over slavery. And most people don't know why he was shot. They think that Booth was a nut, that he was insane, that he was, you know, the typical story about the assassins in our country is they're lone, insane gunmen, hell bent on some political manifesto, as if that makes people homicidal. fill us in on what they're getting wrong.
Oh, gosh. I might be going for a bit here.
Go for it.
I guess the best way to define it is that during the early 1800s, with the around 1812, 1815, whenever Haiti had their revolution, this freaked the South out big time because they're a newly formed country, they're newly formed colonies. They're seeing that slaves can revolt and then, you know, take power and reclaim the island as their own. This is what was the beginning stages, well, what was setting the South's mentality of we cannot have that down here. I guess that's what you could say was the origins of keeping it solely in a racial class, as in with skin tone, as you know, because we always skip over the French, Irish aspect of the slaves that were there. But
what's the Irish aspect of the slaves over there?
So a lot of them, one of them was actually a grandfather of mine. He was on the Mayflower. His name was Sole, and that's Soule. And apparently he was an indentured Irishman that was going along with one of the families there. Again, indentured is your slave or servant
right.
for a certain period of time, and then you gain your freedom after you've worked off whatever loan, money, multiple issues, like money lender issues. Your father owed something. There's multiple aspects of how you would get into the indentured field, where you just wanted to book passage and the other person paid for it for you, and then that you would work for them for a number of years, and then you get, you know,
yeah,
you get your freedom back. So the Irish were treated horrible. I'll probably be doing a post on that because I was reading an article, and we totally bypassed, like, one of the first slave owners in America, if I'm not mistaken, he was the first. His name was Anthony Johnson. And he went to court to ensure that his black slave stayed under his roof, whatever his contract was actually over. He went to court and saying, no,
to make it so it's property.
Yes. Yes. That we totally bypassed that in history. So I'm like, yeah. Anyway, so going back to like 18, 14, 15, somewhere within that period of time, this is when the wheels began turning in the South with how can we start fixing this issue? And then you had the Amistad incident in the 1840s, where they made the movie with Anthony Hopkins and Matthew McConaughey. I absolutely loved it. I was actually impressed that Spielberg touched on that subject. But again, 20-something years ago, a lot of them were touching stuff that I was like, okay, I guess that makes sense. But it was very insightful for me because it helps connect a lot of the dots of the books that I read and getting a visual perspective. I'm like, okay, that makes a lot more sense now. So by the 1850s, we started getting a group that was coming up into play. And I don't know all their names because I read a ton. I don't remember all their names. But now, Knights of the Golden Circle book is for like $35. You can get it on Amazon if you're interested in learning how they forged in Texas. They started creating an empire that they wanted from the Confederacy states to California, Mexico, a good portion of all the South American countries. So like Venezuela, almost. It included Cuba, Haiti, and Jamaica. That was going to be the golden circle of slavery. Basically, we have our own vision of how we want this half of the world to go. Whatever you guys want to do in the North, be our guest. We don't want to deal with that anymore. And so their vision was to have this already in play. And when you're hearing about John Brown, are you familiar with that guy?
Not off the top of my head.
He was the individual that was kind of called like the crazy, what do you call it? Trying to think of the term. Is it abolitionist? Abolitionist, I think it was, right? Abolishing slavery.
Oh, so he was for the end of it.
Yes, but he was going to do it via violent means. But what I've been reading, again, this is strictly theory. I do not have definitive proof. But one of his first incidents or acts of violence was against a guy in Kansas. He rode up to the guy's house in the middle of the night, pulled him out, and his sons and him beat him up with like this broadsword, and they freaking killed the guy. But what I'm reading with the Golden Circle is that they're from Texas, but they were all the way up into Kansas, Missouri region. I'm beginning to think that John Brown was like, you guys want to go violent? I'm going to go violent with you guys because I want to end this in a righteous way. John Brown actually made it all the way to Harper's Ferry, Virginia, and he was going to be arming the slaves down there by taking over the military, wherever they were storing all the ammo and stuff like that, and then go through the South, start arming the slaves for a revolt. What people don't know is that John Wilkes Booth was present for that whole incident. He came down when the Virginia militia, this is where Harper's Ferry is located, they were starting to freak out. They're like, okay, we need to get everybody down there. John Wilkes Booth was at a theater at the time. I'm not sure if it was the Ford's Theater or another one.
It was Ford Theater, yeah.
Yeah. I read another book on him. And he was at one of those theaters. And he's like, you know what? I'm just going to drop my job and I'm going to join the militia that head down there and stop this whole thing. And they get there in the aftermath. They make sure that there was this group that was maybe going to be doing a jailbreak for John Brown, didn't go down because of all these extra guns that were around. And John Wilkes Booth actually talked with John Brown, and he was totally against abolitionists. He didn't like them at all. And when he saw John Brown hang, he said to the guy next to him, he says, I'm never going to be going down like that. If ever comes push comes to shove, I'm not going to go out like that. It just seemed like a long, drawn out process. He didn't like that aspect at all. So the Knights of the Golden Circle, I'm not sure how or when, but I do know that Booth had a tour that went through Oklahoma and the Texas region, and that's possibly when they recruited him, because he was a member. And that's something that a lot of times, again, not a crazed gunman, because if you're part of an organization and you know what their root causes and stuff like that, you start connecting some more dots. And again, I've read these other guys that are part of this, you know, Civil War Association, this group, blah, blah, and they're kind of like, no, some people theorize this, but I start connecting dots and names, and I start making a little bit of a compiling of, oh, okay, I know who was the one that recruited you. I know now the guy that connected you to this guy. And then the aftermath, it's just damning all the way. And that's the book that I posted that you were referring to. So Booth, when he was 13, I believe he was 13 years old, he talked to a gypsy lady and she did a palm reading. And she says that you will have a quick and fast life and you will go out with the nation screaming your name.
Wow. That's what he said?
That's what she told him as a prophecy reading his palm.
But how do we know that? Because did he write that, or did he tell someone that?
He was there, I think, with his sister, if I remember correctly. I think her name was Asia Booth. He ran up to her and said, this is what she said. And he kind of was chuckling himself. He's like, yeah, sure. But that's actually, lo and behold, as he was dying, he couldn't move his arms and his hands, but he is asking someone to lift them up. And they did. And the first thing, he looks at both hands after he said, mama, he looked at both his hands and said, useless, useless. Then he died.
Wow.
Yeah. And I'm like, whoa, talk about a full circle of having a flashback, your whole life flashing before your eyes, right before you die, you know? So Booth was recruited by the Knights of the Golden Circle. This is my best thing that I got going on. And when he went up into Montreal, Canada, this is where they started planning. This is where they started coordinating. How are we going to take out Lincoln? And there's a quote in the book, let me try to get the name, Montreal City of Secrets. And as I was talking on Nick's podcast, whoever edited his book, I feel so bad for him. He only needed like 110 pages to tops, but a lot of it started repeating itself.
Yeah.
Or like, it was just like they just threw it all into the book. They're just like, we're not even going to bother editing. But what I did find in there is that this Montreal was where the Confederacy had their hub, their main hub for their Secret Service, because it was perfectly perched right into New York, to Vermont, to getting into all the northern cities, especially New York, which is where they were building the Monitor, where they had they were burning several cities at one point for sabotage. It's also where they coordinated the St. Albans raid. A lot of people aren't familiar with that, but with the contingency of Confederacy soldiers that went into St. Albans, robbed several banks, then rode back into Canada. That was all planned in Montreal.
Wow.
That caused a huge incident in 1864. And they were all like, are you serious? You guys were planning an invasion, basically, a neutral territory, and you guys didn't do jack about it. So that caused a whole scandal and almost got us back into a war with England after the Trent Affair. But Booth was up there, and he even bragged that even if Lincoln gets in again to this next election, or if he doesn't, He says he's going to be meeting his, I think, Karam something. Basically, it was a term that when all the balls are going to fall into the place with the holes, this is going to be his last time ever as president. So the fact that he made that little braggadocious claim and this guy was he witnessed it, he talked about it later on. It was like, okay, so this wasn't just a crazed gunman. This is a record of witness having a conversation with him over a pool table that this was going to go down.
Why was Booth so invested? Why did he have such animosity and hatred for Lincoln? I mean, I was saying, you know, I mean, he sounds like, you know, a sophisticated militia KKK member. You know what I mean? There seems to be a hatred. I'm not sure where it comes from, but I still understand. It still takes someone who's willing to sacrifice their life,
mm-hmm.
who's willing to die, to walk up to a president in a theater like that.
Right.
I mean, that is, that's great. How did he go from, you know, what seems to be, you know, like, you know, a militiaman, you know, a military person who is strategizing to, you know, let's just go kamikaze here and I'll just take him out myself. How do we get to that?
And that's what a lot of people don't talk about, is that there was originally a plan to kidnap Lincoln to end the Civil War. And this was actually, I think it was a lieutenant or a captain, I'm forgetting his name, but he was the one that pitched the idea saying, what if we get him when he's going to visit his wife's little cottage, whatever is connected to the family, and we could grab him, we'll run down into Richmond, Virginia, we'll basically then make a bargaining chip saying we're going to end the war right now, we'll give you back your president.
Yeah.
You know, all done. And basically, through a fluke, there was a contingency of 24 cavalry soldiers that decided to join Lincoln on that trip.
Mm.
And they're like, okay, there's only 6 to 8 of us. That's not going to work.
Nah.
So things had to start getting escalated. The original plan with Booth, from what all the stuff that I've gathered, it was supposed to be another abduction. But things didn't go according to plan. They basically were like, okay, we're going to have to upgrade now because we're not going to be able to do it that way. So I think this was the second contingency plan, but I think part of it, Booth has always didn't like the things that Lincoln was doing. In the other book that I read, Booth was incredibly generous. He was actually a real gentleman. He would like help and advise people on stage where to stand, how to recite their lines. He was an individual that made sure people got certain gigs and stuff like that. His dad was a prominent actor, also a Mason.
Well, his brother was the most famous actor walking around, right, at the time. Yes.
And he hated living in the shadow of his brother. So there was a little bit of that. It wasn't his main motivation at all. Towards the night of, though, there was like a theater assistant guy that he was at a bar with. And the guy even made a comment to Boots saying, you're never going to be as great as your brother or your dad. I'm like, well, that's, and then like, I think it was like within 5-8 minutes of that phrasing being said, Booth was in the theater, shot Lincoln, jumped down from the stage, and as he was running in the back, he cut that guy with his dagger.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Just little things like that. When I'm reading, I'm just like, holy cow. There's so many little details that build up to who the guy was, what his lifestyle was. He was an incredible womanizer. He had 5 pictures of women in his coat pocket. One of them he was engaged to. Never talk about that.
Wow.
He was at Lincoln's second inauguration. We never talk about that.
Wow.
Yeah.
So this is fascinating because obviously we know that the elites are involved. Whenever there's a war, the elites are involved. So where do they fit in this equation? I'm sure they were backing both the North and the South because that's what they've learned to do and do well, you know.
Correct.
Back every horse so you can't lose. But, you know, they usually have one horse that they're more riding than the other. That they have more,
right.
You know, they would like to see win more, and that's the one they'll invest more in.
Right.
Which horse were they backing, and what was their involvement in this? Were they pro or I mean, obviously they were probably pro because in anything that is pro industry, regardless of its ethics or morality, they're for, right. You know.
Right.
So I imagine they were more on the side of the South, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
absolutely. They were more pro the side of the South, and that's where it connects to the Catholic Church in the book that I was reading. The minute the papacy basically declared the South its own sovereign country, the North had a huge desertion, or people just leaving ranks. Not, you know, they're like, I'm not doing it anymore. And the guy listed the numbers of how many were Catholics that bailed during this time. A lot of them are saying, this is where we started getting the draft riots, I believe, in the movie with Leonardo DiCaprio and what's his face? Last of the Mohicans. You guys will know who it is.
Yeah, Daniel Day-Lewis.
That's the guy. Yeah, that's where that whole scenario where they were doing the draft riots and stuff like that, that games in New York, that was all going on during this time.
Okay.
Again, multiple things were at play. Yes, there was some racial issues and race riots and stuff like that. But it was because people were basically saying, why am I fighting this war anymore? Especially if the Catholic Church basically approves, gives their thumbs up of saying this is its own country. In the South, the bad guys, who they had in play was Judah Benjamin. And he was in charge of the Secretary of War at first, and then he ended up being the guy in charge of the Secret Service. So this is their little connection there. He was the only Jewish member of the cabinet down in the Confederacy. And again, I would love to just write a book or just do posts on the cabinets of both sides, because you learn so much from the personal lives of each individual in the cabinet. What's their motivations? What did they do in their personal life?
So
yes, they were definitely betting on the South. What's the name of the place? Drawing a blank up the name, but this is where the ship, the Alabama, was made. And the Alabama was a huge, what do you call it? The blockade that was controlling the South. The Alabama was basically a rogue hunting ship that was sinking Union ships all over. They went to the China Seas. They hit European Union vessels. They hit up in Massachusetts, everywhere. They were notorious. And this was built. Liverpool, that was it. It was built in Liverpool, England. When we get the Trent Affair going on, I think this was in 62, 63, and they captured the two Confederacy guys that were going over there as emissaries. Mm-hmm. That merely propelled England into joining. They literally sent soldiers that were already north in Canada. They sent a guy down to talk to Lee, and he actually witnessed the forces on the field. He's like, you got a skimpy army, but these guys are loyal to you. That's impressive. He was giving compliments. Mm-hmm. They were coordinating all kinds of battle stuff. They were going to send a whole bunch of steamers across the ocean. This is where Lincoln was like, crap, I think we're going to have to turn over the emissaries and going to have to call this off, because I cannot fight two fronts. But this is what they actually were wanting. This is why they did the St. Albans raid in 64. They kept trying to irk and getting the support, the an additional alliance of either France and or England to just join and help tip the scales of the battle. This was actually one of the primary reasons why Lincoln was signing the Emancipation Proclamation, because both of those countries, while they were talking a big game over in Europe about possibly joining the Confederacy, he knew that both of those countries had banned slavery. So if he signs the Emancipation Proclamation, this is a double-edged sword saying, if you guys join, you'll be joining the side that's pro-slavery still. And that's totally hypocritical of what your family says you stand for now. So it was a double edge, because even though people are trying to take one quote out of context, say if he could end the war without ending slavery. And again, you have to understand his mentality is that he's like, this is what they want. I get it. But if I could end the war, well, everyone tries to amplify that and saying, oh, he was totally racist.
Yeah, no, I know. I don't believe that. I think he saw and had a problem with slavery.
He did.
You know, absolutely. I think he did. I think he was, you know, and there was a lot of reasons why he went to war, but I don't believe that the hype about, oh, he was actually, you know, tyrant. I don't think it's that ever that simple.
It's not.
Because there's a lot of reports about him being
examples. When he was like 7, 6 years old, the first time he saw a black guy was pulling a cart like an ox. And that was the first thing that resonated with him is just like, how can somebody be so inhumane as to do that to somebody else?
Yeah.
The second incident was when he was down in Louisiana during his riverboat days, and he witnessed a slave auction going on there, and that really triggered him off. He literally told his guys, like, I got to get out of here. I can't stand another minute watching that go on. So when you're looking at what was pre-Lincoln, it doesn't sound like he was pro-slavery at all to me. It sounds like, yes, I understand they have their preferences and whatnot. But every time I'm looking at incidences with Lincoln, he was always a guy that went up against the crowd.
And yeah.
Even the Spanish-American War, he said something where he's like, how do we know where the borderline is? And that made all of his colleagues were pissed at him. Like, why do you got to be the one guy that's asking that question? Like, I just want to spend, you know, Union blood. I just don't want to uselessly throw it out there. This is not a war that we need to be doing. So he wasn't pro-war and maniac. I mean, you got to look into Buchanan. I was getting in an argument with a lady online. I'm like, you know what? I'm not even going to continue. But I gave her all these references and quotes of how to support my argument. And she just kept saying, well, did you read this author's book? I'm like, well, is she like that's referring me to the CDC at this point? I'm sorry. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm giving you five
exactly.
books. You're just you're telling like, me this one author who's proclaiming the tyrant narrative, you know?
Yeah, of course. That's his story, right?
Right, right.
People, man.
Continue with what you were saying, supporting both sides. This is where going down the rabbit hole, both books. Edwin Stanton, who was Secretary of the War under Lincoln. He was a backstabbing, not a good guy. Mm. He, his brother-in-law was in Montreal. He checked in directly after by the name of Sarah Slater in the hotel where it was known to be a huge Confederacy hub. And he used his own name. Now, if this is a time of war, I don't think you're going to be an idiot in not knowing the name of the national, international police agency.
Right.
The Union, you're going to know who it is. You're not using an alias, and you're signing in directly after somebody who is known to be a Booth conspirator later on. Mm-hmm. So him and another guy, Lafayette Baker, who is in charge of the Secret Service for the Union, blah, blah, blah. He's like one of Edwin Stanton's most trusted guys. They were up there in 64.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of backroom dealing in 64, October. There was a cotton for contraband deal that was being made by Lincoln. And this is one of those scandalous things. Because this is right before election. You're doing this in the middle of a wartime. But they were going to make a deal with people in the South. Say, we'll give you some contraband, like guns and stuff like that. But we need cotton. Remember, this is at least three, 4 years into a war. Your industries are kind of in a crappy situation.
Nice.
At the same time, you really want to keep funding the enemy.
Right.
So, this whole deal was going on. While this was going on, Stanton, the Secretary of State, he sent a guy up there. Edwin Stanton sent his guys up there. So there was it's like a Game of Thrones thing. Everybody's sending up their secret agents to get their own agenda going on.
Yeah.
To how they end this. Edwin Stanton, once Booth was dead, he had Booth's journal or diary. And by the time he turned it over, there were like 19 pages that were missing.
Yeah. Oh, no kidding. I'm sure.
The guy, Lafayette Baker, he ended up dying of arsenic poisoning.
Go figure.
Yeah. I mean, it's one thing after the other. And I'm just like, Edwin Stanton, you freaking stabbed him in the back. He knew early as March or late February. Because they're in Montreal, they were all bragging about it. They knew what was going to be coming up.
Yeah.
And he knew as early as March that this was going to be going down. And he didn't do anything to stop it.
So my theory is that behind every assassination of this magnitude, there is a strong, cabal, Illuminati, New World Order, momentum carrying it in.
Right.
You know, forwarding it. Funding, everything from, whatever kind of conditioning that needs to go on into the minds of the people involved, it's all put into play,
right?
And put into play in every level that is possible, And I'm wondering, and as soon as you mentioned Rome, and I'm like, okay, so then the Illuminati was involved because they had direct ties to Rome. In fact, many would argue that that is the representative of Rome. The black nobility, the Illuminati. That's where they come from. And they have their hand in virtually every world event of that nature. So,
right.
Tell me how how did they affect their influence? Because this is what they do so well.
So basically, how Lincoln got onto their crap list is that back, I think it was 38 or in the 40s. whenever he was practicing law as his main thing, he defended a gentleman in Illinois who was basically being accused by a Jesuit priest. And Lincoln basically, with his way of words and getting a little witness to come in and sign an affidavit. You can find this stuff in the book. The guy, Rome's Responsibility for the Assassination of Abraham Lincoln. The gentleman who compiled all this information, put it all in the book. You can find it. You can find this letter and source that he used in the court.
Okay.
He basically made this guy look like a complete idiot with the scandal that he was trying to do against this other guy that was trying to leave the Catholic faith. And this guy ended up Father Chinique. And he later on would visit Lincoln saying, you know, they're probably going to try to take you out. You made them really mad. And he's like, I have no doubt that they will. And there's even a quote in 63 of Lincoln even saying, if the American people knew how much the Catholic Church was distorting our education, blah, 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 then this is a direct quote. And nobody is bringing this fact up that he realized if he had said anything that the Catholics were behind a lot of the motivation in the South, or they were influencing and having workings down there, that this would turn into a religious war, as opposed to just a civil war. And he says, that's going to be 10 times worse than what we got right now.
Yeah.
As a guy that would pace the rooms at night, his secretary, Jonathan Hayes, would say he would be crying and saying, why, after he'd get like a battle report, why?
Yeah.
This was a guy who was remorseful every time blood was shed.
Yeah.
There was a massacre this is a guy that got really involved.
He had a true conscience. Yeah.
He did. And that's, again, every time I'm reading about Lincoln, this does not sound like the narrative of a traitor or somebody that was trying to be a tyrant.
No, that's all.
Literally was like, why? Why does this even have to be a thing?
Well, what Lincoln, I think, realized also is, you know, you get up to that level and you start playing around, and he had to have been informed, unlike maybe some of the presidents today, you know.
Right.
The players, you know what I mean? Just as Benjamin Franklin and our forefathers knew the players, you know, Lincoln came into power at a time when presidents still knew the players. Now,
right.
You know, it's much more compartmentalized.
Murky.
Yeah. So he had to realize the involvement of, you know, this huge establishment that was a prominent part of society at the time. And what are you going to do? Break the news to everyone? Everyone's going to call you the Antichrist if you do that, you know. So yeah, I could see why he was obsessed,
because they hide behind their charities and those special organizations to make them seem like they're the good guys. But that's, again, that's perfect money laundering right there. I mean, you seem like a nice holy institution, and same thing with the Catholic Church. They're loaded and have more money than God, but at the same time they're saying we need help when a church burns down in modern day. It's like,
dude, they've said they still, they're handing baskets around.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I was like, wait, what? The Vatican is still sitting on as much gold as any country. I mean, literally.
They are their own country.
They are their own country. Exactly. Isn't that amazing? The Vatican, Washington, D.C., and that little part of London, they all have something in common, right?
Yes.
Why they've made their own little stomping grounds there.
The banking, the military, and the religion. I mean, if you got those three, you can control anybody. But
that's right.
Connect with the Catholic Church, Booth's co-conspirator, John Surratt, and this is where it gets good. You can actually Google John Surratt right now if you wanted to, or show an image, and you will find him in a Papal Guard uniform from the 1800s.
Wow.
Yeah. And this is in the book, too. And after the assassination goes down, he goes back up to Montreal, Canada, hides with two Jesuit priests for 5 months, and then they put him on a steamer. I believe it was called the Peruvian. And he goes to Liverpool, England. Now, remember, Liverpool, England is where they were building all these blockade runner boats.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody spots him over there, or he messages one of his buddies, and he basically says, oh, crap, I know they're looking for this guy. There's a $100,000 bounty. So they make the call. They let them know, saying, hey, we got your guy over here. We know he's staying at this church. Do you want us to go apprehend him? Edward Stanton intentionally goofs up the whole freaking response, basically. Like, it's not.
That's why he's there. No. That's why he was there, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. I'll make sure this guy gets away. And he goofs it all up. At the same time, President Johnson, who was also a Mason and also was affiliated with Booth back in Tennessee, they used to hang out and date some women.
Mm-hmm.
And a little sidebar, he claims he was drunk at the night of the assassination. What really occurred is that Booth got a letter from a woman that was right next to the theater or whatever. It was close by. and he used to hang out with her all the time. And she said, you know, I'll let you do anything you want with me. And he basically, what the, I can put together, he made her sleep with the president that night. The door was supposed to be open. The guy was supposed to go in, but he lost his nerve, didn't stab him. So to avoid scandal with sleeping with a promiscuous woman, he claimed I was drunk, as opposed to admitting, I think I just got duped. I could have lost my own life during this incident.
So, wait, who did that now?
President Johnson, the vice president.
Now it's, okay.
Yeah, but he also was a Mason. Again, I think there's certain degrees of Masons where some of their clubs can work against each other, or did at the time, because remember, it's order through chaos. As you can have different views, you can have different opinions, but at the end of the day, we want our own, you know, we're going to get our end agenda across. So right. When he cancels this whole bounty on Surratt and company, that's incredibly suspicious, especially when you get a call that you've got the second guy that's probably the most, you know, involved character of this whole thing. So yeah. this fluke goes on. He escapes. He goes to a little town outside the Vatican. He joins the Papal Guard, takes that photo. And another independent private investigator felt the need to go down there, trace him, found him. The Catholic Church is like, all right, our hands are tied. We can't keep, you know, hiding you.
Sheltering the guy, yeah.
Yeah. So they hand him over, but he escapes again, conveniently. Mm. They finally get him in Egypt. They bring him back. He goes on
trial. Jesus, he went all the way to Egypt to hide, and they still
went? Cairo. Yep, and they
extradited
him back to the U.S. He goes on trial. The guy, Thomas Miley Harris, the guy that was recording all this in 1885 in his book, said every single one of the people that were on the jury were Catholics. Yeah, gets off, and he ends up going on tours for the rest of his life. When he dies, he's buried with the full Catholic Church royal honors.
Wow.
Was supposed to be the son of a shoe clerk. What did you do? Because that's only reserved for people who did great things for the church, like a saint or something.
Yeah.
What did you do?
Wow.
So what needs to be also noted is that out of all the countries in Europe that sent their condolences after Lincoln died, the only one that was silent was the Vatican.
Figures.
In 1866, Congress passed a law forbidding all ambassadorial funds to the Vatican.
Wow. They were like,
what's the reason,
guys?
Until 117 years later, when Reagan goes to visit the Vatican.
Wow. That is.
Yeah, crazy. That's what the real significance of all that was. And remember, Reagan went to Bohemian Grove. So when you start connecting those dots, you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. It's all one big game. And you guys were fixing the connection that got ripped apart then. But you had to wait some time, because if you did it right away, you're offering your, you know.
Reagan was also dealing in considerably more money than previous presidents with the Star Wars and the whole, which ended up being a bit of a, you know, I mean, the entire Cold War was orchestrated and continued for decades solely for, you know, this the laundering of money, and of course some of it was put into these weapons, but you know, once you know how to make them, then, well, you know, I mean, the amount of money that Reagan funneled to the secret space program is enormous. And of course it was all under the guise of, you know, well, we have to compete with Russia. Meanwhile, the Rothschilds are the ones funneling the nuclear secrets to Russia, because you can't have a nuclear war if one side doesn't have nukes.
Right. Right.
Go America. Just like the Vietnamese, the Viet Cong, you know, we were funneling the North Vietnam soldiers, even sometimes through Russia. This is how far the United States will go to keep a war going. We're like, keep the party going. We are the R. Kelly of fucking war. Anything to keep the party going. You know, it's just, it's insane. People have no idea the truth of these wars. You know, we've funded both sides of every war, sometimes getting caught red-handed and just being like, well, I don't know. You know, I mean, Obama would have them drop the weapons off, and the soldiers would be like, but if we just leave them there, then the opposite army is going to get them. And, you know, of course, they're like, follow your fucking orders. Do what you're told. That's why you have your job.
Right.
But, like, I mean, it's just the amount of stupidity that there's no willpower.
Right. Right.
It's a shame. But if people knew the truth, they would be shocked. you know, they would be shocked. So that's fascinating that I had no idea Rome was so involved. I should have known because they're involved in most things. Now, it's funny that these days,
the Jesuits.
And the Jesuits, you know, who probably have the worst reputation out of, well, a lot of them have bad reputation, but the Jesuits are kind of, you know, like, there's such animosity for the Jesuits. And I'm like, so I've read a little bit about it, but I don't know a lot of where that animosity comes from, what the Jesuits did to earn it. Because at one point...
I could send you some links for that.
Yeah, I would love to learn more about it. But I know at one point, like, everyone seemed to be at war with the Jesuits. I was like, what the hell are the Jesuits? What were they doing? Pissing everybody off.
Yes, they were. A lot of, even Napoleon knew that he was probably going to be poisoned. That's why he had the liver issue. That's why he couldn't, that's why he lost the Battle of Waterloo. He was dealing with, it's not shingles, but it was some kind of disease where he was crapping. And he couldn't sit on top of his horse and survey the battlefield. And that's why he kept making out these bad calls about what to do. And that was from him trying to poison himself after the first time he got caught, he failed. But he's pretty convinced that that later on in life, that's who was going to do him in was the Jesuits, because they always use poison as their number one way of taking people out.
And the so what was the Jesuits? Who was telling the Jesuits what to do? Which part of the elite were controlling the Jesuits, I guess, is my question.
That goes back to the Black Pope, and that's basically a guy who shadows the Pope, but he's the ones making the calls.
The real Pope, yeah.
Yeah, he's the one making the real calls. And basically, that them and the Jesuits, they've had a frenemies relationship through the years. The guy, Adam Weishaupt, when he left the Jesuit order, he's the one.
Oh, I know that name, yeah.
Yeah, he's the one that said, I'm going to create the Illuminati. And he ended up finding some Jewish Masons that they wanted to go rogue. And they said, we're going to infiltrate all the secret societies. And that way we'll be able to have our own little, we'll dictate the acts of what goes on around the world. So a lot of times the Jesuits and the Masons would be like, all right, we'll shake hands on this one. But the next time, I'm not going to be friends with you. So there was a lot of double motivations going on. But the Catholic Church has been its own entity because they don't want to lose their religious grip and power over the people. So that's why they keep going after the activists. They keep going after people that are calling them out. I mean, I'm surprised Martin Luther survived.
Yeah,
that one genuinely surprises me, because every time somebody started speaking out against the church, they had to silence them.
It usually didn't take them long, and it's just at some point there became, now I know there's the rift was made during the Civil War, and so I think in some ways the United States, in the same vein as the Church of England, created its own independent power here, at least for a while, that I think the Vatican and Rome was like, fuck those guys, we'll get them next time. For now,
right.
You know, obviously still having influence and being involved in the corporate matters in the way that the Vatican can be,
right,
very clandestinely. But that makes sense to me, because, the only thing that happened was the rich folks in England and then eventually America were like, why don't we just do what they're doing? What I'm saying? Why give them all the money and power? You know what? Let's just create our own church called the Church of England. You know what I mean?
Well, that's one thing.
Why would you have to not pay taxes? Yeah.
You know how Rothschild came into power, right? In England?
I know. I heard that he was working with someone, and then they died and he got an inheritance, right?
And that's where he got the money, yes.
He got that money, and then that was during the French Revolution, or right before it, right?
Right.
And so he figured out how to manipulate. This was the first time he was successfully, built himself a fortune virtually overnight by crashing a market, right?
Right.
And so what happened was the Battle of Waterloo, right?
I think it was a little
maybe prior. Wasn't that
a little bit prior?
Yeah, it was a big battle, right?
Right.
And of course he had his part of his family right there on the ground, right? And he actually rode from the battle to be the first one right? Because they knew they had one shot at this and they had a small window before news spread, right?
Right.
Finish the story for me. Tell everyone what these guys did.
The French, they basically spun the story in the War of 1812 that the French had landed on English soil. French army's going to be coming and taking up all of your freaking, you know, they're going to burn the city, yada, yada.
Yeah.
So it's telling everybody, run, 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 run. And everybody's like, well, if I run, I want, you know, I have my business here, blah, blah, blah. So he's like, I'll buy it for you. I'll buy it for you. Pennies on the dime.
Yeah.
He buys up square after square after square. These people all leave town. And the next thing you know, he's in charge of all these streets, all these businesses with that fortune. But a totally worthwhile investment because now you own the majority of England. Now you're known as the Lords of London. You're more powerful than the freaking English family because you have the money.
I heard that he even brought word that there was a massive defeat,
yes.
Right? And that and so
talked about the invasion.
Yeah, that the invasion was successful and that it was, you know, it was a slaughter. And so that I don't know if they were called stocks at the time, but basically everything dropped. And so the seed money he had inherited, he immediately started buying everything and everything he could that was of value right there.
Yep.
And then, of course, he had created the lie that they lost. You know, yep. The fact was that they won. There was victory. So what happened was, you know, there's like, oh, it was a mistake. It turns out we didn't lose. Yay. You know, meanwhile, he had bought everything at fire sale prices.
Yep.
Reminds me a little bit of 2020.
Hmm? Yeah.
You know, and then sold some of it back at normal prices, right. You know, so he's like, it's like playing blackjack, doubling down, doubling down, doubling down, doubling down, and then hitting blackjack. You know, that's how you make a lot of money in one hand. And that's exactly what he did. Sorry, my dog barked. Yeah, and that's how the Rothschilds went from, you know,
small potatoes.
Players, but virtually overnight, they went from, you know, to a global force because they had strong-armed all of England. And at the time, England was one of the most powerful countries in the world.
They basically put England in a place where they had to come to negotiate.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, they still are calling the shots. And I'm not sure if you watched the part where I was talking about this with Nick, but there was a quote by General Cornwallis. This was actually written in a book, but you can't find this now in the Library of Congress. You can find it in the book Bloody Zion by Edward Hendry. You actually might want to get him on here because a lot of the stuff I get about the Catholic Church, he's the one that compiled the book about Lincoln. He has this quote in there, and the guy wrote the book in 1781 called The Legions of Satan. And this guy says to Washington, says, within 200 years, this country will, he says, you might have won this war. You got your little revolution, but within 200 years, you'll be worshiping the Jewish religion and you're going to be freaking doing the bidding of the crown.
Wow.
Makes that threat. And this matches now, if you rewind back to John Dee, he's the one that was practicing Enochian magic in the Elizabethan court that opposed on that. And all his symbolism that goes back to the Tower of Babel. And the reason they built Babel where it was is because that's where the fallen Nephilim from Genesis 6:4 that I mentioned earlier. That's where they were locked up after their violation, creating the giant offspring that we read about in the Bible. That's why we build churches on top of freaking dead saints and so, because it's consult those dead spirits. So the whole concept of church buildings itself, totally not biblical. But he also had the vision of having a whole empire of Christianity. When he was consulting to John Dee, when he was consulting the other side, they kept saying to him, we want all the religions to be one. And then that will instigate the apocalypse and the return of Christ. But in reality, these Nephilim that are locked up, they want to come back out and have play day and cause problems. But this, when Cornwallis says this quote, the guy who recorded it was a guy by the name of Colonel John Williams. And he was one of the first officers at West Point. Like the author said, he says, I looked up the guy. I tried to see where he was, if he was actually a real person. And he finds all this other evidence. He says, I have fine credibility that this guy existed. And McCarthy gave a speech, Senator McCarthy, the McCarthyism from the 1950s. He gave a speech and he quoted this and they freaking silenced him for it. This is where it goes.
Wow.
Zionism, Rothschilds, all that. They freaking silenced him for calling this out. The Star of David connects back to this. It's not the, It's not connected to David. It's not connected to King Solomon. That's connected to the Saturn, and Saturn is the star that connects to Nimrod. The pentagram is the one that connects to Ashtaroth or Satan, yeah. His wife. And then the all-seeing eye that you see celebs do, that goes back to their son, Tammuz. So there's a religion going on in this world that people are totally unaware of, and it's still going on today. But yeah. Yeah.
And you got to worship at the altar of it if you want to be Rihanna. Well, yes. And maybe Rihanna's, yeah, but Beyonce and Jay-Z, certainly. Some of them are just, you know, flagrant.
Yeah.
I mean, and people are like, they're just staying okay.
Yes. It's so hard for me. I do that all the time at work. And I'm just like, all right, French kiss. I'm going to do the chef's kiss.
Do that instead.
Because I can't, like, now that I know what that means, it also means 666. That's how many fans it goes around.
Now I see it. Yeah. I was wondering why they do that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and these people, when they do this, you know, they think that they're worshiping. I mean, don't get me wrong. There's different facets of it, right? I mean, mm-hmm. Some of them believe that they're worshiping this entity. Some of them even believe that entity, you know, is evil, so to speak, you know, and that's some of the very darker sides of this. And others believe that, oh, it's just, you know, that the all-seeing eye represents knowledge, and that they believe that Satan is Lucifer. Lucifer is the enlightened one. You know, they don't see him necessarily as a rival of God, but they worship him as their role model almost, you know,
right.
Because it's enlightenment that they seek. And so you have all these, and you know, some of the darker shit, like what's her face that who's having people, you know, do, you know, fake eating where they're eating people, but it's, you know, most of the time it's fake when it's celebrities.
Yeah.
But that part is very occult and dark, but it's prevalent. You know, don't get me wrong, it's prevalent and it's disgusting. And in that part very much endorses some of the pedophilia you see, you know, that is rampant among these people, and why there's a list right now with the, you know, a long list that has a bunch of people on it who are very famous, some of them statesmen, some of them actors, some of them athletes, who participate in this. Now, you know, the question is, at what point do they start? How did they get pressured into it? You know, but it is a net that is cast.
Right.
If you want to be in this club, you got to play by their rules. If not, then you don't make it very far. And that's the same with a lot of politics, unfortunately. But, you know, the Star of David. So this is how Brandon and I got into this initial discourse. I was like, because he, in his post, I was talking about, you know, I love talking about World War II and our involvement in that. And people, it's shocking for people to realize how involved we were with so many aspects of World War II. But, you know, the part that I get a little fuzzy about, and I'm like, I know that Hitler looked up to Henry Ford, and Henry Ford and Hitler were, you know, they were pals, and they wrote letters, and he had a life-size bust of Hitler, and Hitler had factories right in Germany for the German army, for the Germans. Yep. And, you know, he was giving Adolf a good deal, all around. They were buddies. And in fact, a lot of the brand names of our society were very much pro Hitler. And, you know, you have people constantly want to make the argument that, well, it's because there was so much money in it. And I'm like, okay, sure. But at the same time, you know, people keep trying to tell me like, oh, IG Farben, they were making pesticides. And I'm like, and they just happened to work really well for a gas chamber. And I was like, 1942, you know, all the pesticides were organic in the 30s. And then in the 40s, we saw the advent, really, I mean, of some of the chemicals that were from war being put to more of an industrial use.
Right.
One of them being pesticides. But I'm like, you know, regardless, these people are business moguls. You know, they've come into a very high degree of success for their time by knowing what the fuck they're making, not by like, oh, it's a good investment. Just give them the money. I'm like, what? Wait, what? If your job is to make chemicals and you're investing in that company, you're going to find out what they're making.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? It's not going to be a mystery. Oh, we really didn't know they were going to make that. I'm like, what fucking world do you live in that you could be so naive to imagine like that?
Well, Henry Ford didn't know the trucks were going to be used against the Americans.
Bullshit, he didn't know. He was selling trucks to the Americans too. He didn't care.
Yep.
You know what I mean? That, I mean, people are just incredibly naive when they think about these things. But I don't believe for a second that the Zyklon B gas they used in chambers was a pesticide that they ended up converting. I believe it was gas designed to kill people.
Yeah.
And that it, that's what it was made for. I don't know if you know anything about any of that bullshit, but, you know, I keep seeing
a little bit
make excuses. But, you know, my question is, Hitler was propagandized into believing, I think, in a lot of ways that the enemy were the Jews, that the New World Order, the Illuminati, consisted of a solely Jewish idea and concept and movement and force. And I don't know how accurate that statement is, but my question is, like, you have the Zionists, right?
Yeah.
Which, as I understand it, consists of the Rothschilds, you know,
yes.
Primarily, right? But the Rothschilds are also one of the biggest players and key elements of the Illuminati,
mm-hmm.
And they have been for quite a while, right? So how do you, you know, in one of your posts, you were like, the Zionists are fucking over the industrialists. And I was like, how and why and how is there ever get to be a degree of separation between those two factions? You know what I mean? They seem to be part and parcel and in fact, using each other to play nation states against each other.
Well,
tell me what I'm missing.
That's what I tell a lot of people is that they don't seem to realize when you're hearing Illuminati, you're hearing about the Knights of the Golden Circle, you're hearing about the Knights of Columbia or whatever. It is a multifaceted, designed intentionally hydra, because if one goes down, another one can keep on carrying on the baton of what the end goal mission. It's a long game conspiracy, and they can go on for centuries and years.
Yeah.
And when I'm making that claim, you might want to look up the series Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told.
Yeah, I started watching that shit. I was like, come on, man. I mean, it seemed like such a fluff piece. I was trying to watch it.
It does. It does. But I start connecting it. You have to watch Dr. Walter Veith. He's got Dogmas and Doctrines. He was doing a whole expose exposing the symbolism behind the Masonic stuff. So this,
yeah.
I compiled like a 13-minute thing. It's like a snippet from that. It's a snippet from his lecture. And there's a snippet from a movie, Nuremberg, where the actor says specifically, Brian Cox, he says to the other actor, he says, and where were you during the Jewish Freemasonry, blah, 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 blah. He specifically says,
is it black and white?
Jewish Freemasonry.
Mm-hmm.
And when I watched that bit in the movie, I said, well, okay, I understand the Jewish thing because Holocaust and all that, but what do you mean about this Freemasonry aspect?
Yeah.
Freemasonry actually goes back to the Knights Templar. And again, when you looked up the pirate post that I just did, makes huge sense here. And when you, there's another book that I just bought. I'm forgetting the guy's name. I could probably send it to you later if you so prefer. And he was talking, he makes a strong case that it was Jews that started it after the Khazars. They're the ones that started up the Knights Templar. And when they found this ring down there over in during the Crusades, the sigil that you see, that's modernly on the flag of Israel, the Star of David, that's supposed to be King Solomon's ring. And it was said that he used that ring to control the Nephilim that were under Euphrates to help build the new temple, the King Solomon's temple. So when the Knights Templar found this, they found out, wait, we have access to demonic powers and great forces underneath, like, what do we need Christianity for anymore? So they started spitting on crosses and stuff like that. And then they formed the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry, which connects to Portugal mm-hmm. and Scotland. And this is where Freemasonry came into beginning. So there's that aspect.
Wow.
Yeah. The book.
There's a Scottish Rite. There's a Scottish Rite of Freemasonry building, maybe like 20 miles from here. It's a big building. I was like, what the fuck? The sign is right out front. It's like Scottish something Freemasonry. I was like, I wonder if you just knock. I was like, what? It's crazy. There's a big old building. I was like, right. I thought I was like seeing things. I was like, huh.
I guess they still have meetings, you know?
They still do. And there's several levels of doctrine. So, like, if you're level one, you're only going to get the charities.
Right. This is what people
talk about politics.
And if you're a good person, you know.
Right. Right.
People are like, listen, I'm friends with so many. They're good, good people. I'm like, that's because you're a good person, my friend. You know what I'm saying? Like, they're not bringing you up, you know, you're going to make so far and that's it. You know, that's the way it works. Obviously, that's the way it works. But it's hard for people to believe who have been lifelong members, and that's what they want. They know those people will be genuine when they speak about their Freemason friends. They know that people will hear them and be like, no, man, Johnny's a Freemason. Johnny's got the biggest heart in the world. Yeah,
right.
Of course. You know what I mean? That's so smart, the way they have it set up and compartmentalized, that most people will never believe it. But it's a shame.
And that's
Bohemian Grove,
Who's going to think people who are getting charities and money for cancer kids is actually trying to kill me on a global scale?
Because it's such a small percentage, you know, it's like the top 2-3%.
Right.
If that, maybe 2%, you know.
Are you familiar with the Talmud?
Dude, it sounds super familiar.
If
we're
not
just reading
this would give a lot of credence and understanding than the mentality of Jewish supremacy. So if anybody, this is my first question. If somebody says, oh, you're anti-Semitic, I'll ask them, are you pro-Talmud? They don't know what that book is. I'm going to say, shut up. You don't know what you're talking about, because that's a supremacy book. And you don't know what that book talks about, then that means you support Epstein's Island. That book says you can have sex with a 6-year-old girl. You can have sex with a 3-year-old boy.
Damn.
Yeah. It says it point blank.
I've seen that book referenced, I don't know, 100 times. And I'm always like, it's Talmud. So it's a supremacy book, but it's Jewish supremacy,
right?
And oh my god,
they're still stuck in the mentality of the days after Joshua, and any Gentile, aka Goyim. So when you're watching that clip from Jesse Ventura's one about the vaccines, they said it's almost time for the great culling. Great culling, the culling of a herd, and they call us Goyim. This is, again, cross-reference research. Okay, so culling of the herd. The Talmud basically says that as long as someone else swings the hammer and puts the nail into that individual, and we didn't do it, that was somebody else's actions, we're absolved of any crime. As long as somebody else makes the decision to do that,
you read my mind.
We're not liable. We're God's people. We're still God's people. Jesus doesn't count. And they have in the Talmud, they basically said Jesus basically repented after they put him on the cross and said, oh, bless the Jews, yada, yada. And dispensational Zionism, this was created by the Scofield Bible, and I'm going to explain something significant with that because this connects to Rothschild, says that Jesus is going to come down on earth and he's going to restore an earthly kingdom with the Jews. That's not biblical at all. It says you can't come back into heaven until you accept Jesus Christ as a savior, because you're neither Jew nor Greek anymore. You can come back into the fold.
Right.
A lot of people in their preaching right now, they don't count for Jeremiah 3:8, where it says, I've given Israel the bill of divorce. The Ten Commandments wasn't just 10 commandments of laws. It was a marriage ceremony. This is what I'm expecting from you. And they violated it continually. Can they come back now via Christ? Yes, but the old marriage is gone.
Right.
That's where I would go into the communion aspect and the Mary Magdalene thing, where it states specifically that in Jewish culture, what the dad would do, he would get a young man in town, make sure he had a good standing, he could provide for his daughter, think like the Fiddler on the Roof. I'm making sure that this guy's good for you, because I want to make sure you're going to have a good upbringing, whatever. What would happen then is that they would bring the young man over, they bring the daughter over, they pour a little glass of wine, he would hand it to the man, he'd drink of it. They then take the same glass and hand it to the daughter. Now, it was here where she could respectfully refuse, I don't approve of this match, I don't want to marry this guy. Totally was fine, it was honorable, she has the right to make that decision, we'll move on. It wasn't going to be a forced arranged marriage, she had the choice.
Right.
She accepted it. What would happen then in Jewish culture is that they would add on to the family house and give her an extension, because now she's going to be inducted into the family.
Right.
So when Christ is saying, this is my body, drink of it, blah, 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 I go to prepare a place for you at my
father's
house. We're making
it was literal.
Yes, you're making the conscious choice of a marriage ceremony, accepting God's son. It's a God giving his son. Now you have to make the acceptance of this relationship. So the whole aspect of communion, we've totally diluted from what it was context and culture. But when you understand it, you're like, oh, this, why am I beating myself up saying thank you for dying on the cross for me?
Yeah.
But it's a marriage ceremony. You should be having, like, you know, a party and remembrance.
I mean, and they're like, it's a celebration. Be like, but everyone seems to be in mourning.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, literally.
On this thing.
It's crazy. It's so confused. That's why I feel like they're losing power and ground. And, you know.
They are.
And it's, that is systematic, you know. And RFK Jr. came out and said they're going to be coming after religious exemptions, particularly in the North. And my God, they've virtually eliminated them. You know, there's no religious exemptions anymore for anything.
Right.
And they were like, we'll show you who's in charge. Churches are shut down. Walmart open? Churches, not so much.
Bars.
We'll show you where our priorities are, you know, which is fascinating that people who are, quote, of faith were just like, oh, we have to stay home.
Yeah. Or you have to wear,
you know, try that shit 100 years ago, see what happens, you know?
Yeah. That was the biggest thing. I kept talking to my pastor. I was like, we're supposed to be preaching a story of not fearing death.
Yeah.
That's the core of our thing, but we're wearing an emblem of fear on our face constantly. And I had a hard time when coming to junior church because I'm like, I can't, I feel like a hypocrite. I couldn't do it.
Well, you see why. That is exactly why. Religion has to be weeded out because
absolutely,
you know, it gives people an anchor to something greater than themselves, and that's a problem, you know.
Right,
it's a big problem, especially when there's zeal there. That's a big problem. So that's you see it's happening, and it's like churches are closing, people don't go anymore, people don't go to work anymore, let alone church. You know,
right.
No one wants to go anywhere anymore, but that's what they want. It's easier for them, but man, this is we're running a little low on time. This has been fascinating.
Just two more things.
Tell me. Go ahead.
Yeah, because it'll connect to stuff. I said I was going to say it. The one with the forming of the IRS. I was talking about it earlier, but I said it does connect with the banking thing. Oh, yeah. Rothschild agent. Jacob Schiff. He was the guy that went to Jekyll Island with the senator.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he is the great-grandfather of present-day Adam Schiff.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, when you look into this stuff, but to go further, the stuff that what Hitler's mindset was, when you're looking at the star that he put on the Jewish shoulders, that's basically the whole symbolism of that is saying the cultural elements are more powerful than God. You look up the Walter Veith video, you can find it on Odyssey and I think on YouTube, Morals and Dogma. And it basically was basically branding them saying, you guys think you're better than everybody else in our culture. You think you can control my banking system and stuff like that. He was pissed off, especially after World War One, because in the first 45, 52 minutes of the Hitler thing, if you just want to tolerate that much, it talks about it, where in Germany was kicking England's butt. They had him on their knees. I think it was in October. And basically Rothschild writes a letter to America and says, we basically need your help. If you give us Palestine, yada yada. And this is from a Zionist perspective. He says, we want the promised land. You get that for us, we'll be a done deal. And that's where Hitler was saying, we got backstabbed. And they actually created a whole program, the Tel Aviv Accord, I believe, where Jews would put money into a thing. They would be shipped back to the Palestine-Israeli region.
Yeah.
And then the money that they invested into this would be given back to them. After America stuck their nose into the war, that program got dissolved. That was going on from like the 30s until like 42, 41.
Fiddles run that program.
That was by Germany.
By Germany, right.
Yeah, because they were already having a problem with Jewish businesses boycotting them. And they also were the ones that were introducing, what was it, the pornography and cinema and on stages and plays. And a lot of the Germans were like, what the heck are you doing? And on top of that, or like America, what are you doing to our banking system? We're having a big problem with this. It's a monopoly, and they weren't appreciating it. And now if you're going to be like, oh, come on, you're jumping the gun. I did a post. I read this guy's whole interview. It's from the book Bloody Zion, but this is a portion of his interview of revealing it. He wanted money for banking, gambling thing. And it goes, our power has been created through the manipulation of the national monetary system. The Federal Reserve System has fitted our plan nicely since it is owned by us, but the name implies that it is of the government institution. From the outset, our purpose was to confiscate all the gold and silver, replacing them with worthless, non-redeemable paper notes. We Jews have put issue upon issue to the American people, and we promote both sides of the issue as confusion reigns. With their eyes fixed on the issues, they fail to see who is behind every scene. We Jews toys with the American people as a cat toys with a mouse. He was murdered 30 days after this interview. This is back in 1976.
Did he really fucking say that, though? Or
was it a bunch of votes? He admitted the whole thing, and then they were like, dude, shut up. He was talking about how...
Oh, so he just was a narcissist and could not keep his mouth... Oh, I think I read about this guy. They were like, shut up. We're not invincible. And this guy kept spouting off because he thought... It basically was acting like the war was won. And we were like, dude, we're still fighting. You can't tell him this shit. And he was like, I am the smartest. We are the greatest, you know, and they were like, sit down and shut up. I was reading about this cat. Wow, that's crazy.
I can send you the audio reading. I'm sorry I did for that. But yeah, and it was like, almost blew the lid. And this is what Hitler was talking, or the whole issue that was going on there. He didn't have the Jewish problem until they're basically saying, we can't allow this Palestinian deal to keep going on where you're getting people out of here.
Wow. I mean, it's so much. It's still a little confusing, but...
Oh, I could go on. If you want to have me back on explaining the star religion.
That's what I'll have to do, because I got to go get dinner ready. But
Totally.
We'll have to do it again, my friend. It's been real. We covered a lot, and there's a lot more we can get into. So we'll do it again sometime soon. I appreciate all your time and your knowledge. You know, Brandon is a young man. He's born in 1994. So to see a young man who is so well read and just so fervent about acquiring actual knowledge and not the bullshit that they teach you in school, it just gives me a lot of hope for the youth. And it's a pleasure, man, to know you. So we'll be in touch for sure.
Appreciate you having me on. It's been an absolute blast.
And to everyone who remained with us, thank you guys so much. We'll have Brandon back on again. As always, question the answers. And, you know, we'll be in touch when this is going to come out, Brandon.
All right, brother. You take care.